The sun was probably out this morning, but it was hard to tell with all the haze. There's a fire burning 50 miles south of town between the Blair Lakes and the Wood River, and the sky and heavy smell of smoke make it seem like it's right in your own backyard. Though the notion is somewhat frightening, this fire may turn out to be beneficial to some four-footed critters. Moose. Crews are now working to contain the potentially negative effects of the fire, jumping the Wood River and destroying timber with commercial potential for the Togatelli Corporation, then Enana Village Corporation, which hopes to log that land. The smoke hanging heavy over Fairbanks, says Pete Buist, doesn't mean that the fire is spreading or that the moose are in for good times. Buist is the State Division of Lands Information Officer.
Basically, there hasn't been, a change in the fire situation itself. It's more a change in wind that's brought us the smoke.
The wind shift, well disadvantageous for folks hoping to enjoy another bright summer day, gave a boost to the firefighters.
We were able to get a better look at some pieces of the fire that have been smoked in so badly before that we couldn't map them accurately. We now estimate that the total acreage on the fire is 106,000 acres. Our posture on the fire, on the portion of it that the state is managing, is that we're just trying to build hand line. We don't have any equipment out there. We're just trying to build hand line and slow the fire down so that it doesn't hit the Wood River real hard and get across. And we're trying to keep it out of the nice black spruce along the river there, because if it did get up into those, that it would probably cross the river, and there's some significant resource values on the west side of the wood that we do need to protect. The area that most of the fire is burning in is just black spruce over there on the Tanana Flats, and when that is burned, it'll probably come back in willows and will be better for the moose.
Moose are a concern of Dave Johnson's. He's a game biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
After a fire, when the timber is burned, it takes a while for the willows to regenerate. Therefore, isn't it disadvantageous to moose to actually have a burn?
Well, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One is in the short term, one is in the long term. Short term, one of the things that we're seeing now on the Tanana Flats is some of the radio-collared moose that we've been looking at for last few years have moved into some of the older parts of this recent burn. In other words, the burned areas have unlocked some of the nutrients that were bound up in growing plant material, and so it's been kind of like releasing fertilizer out there, and we've got green vegetation coming up, and some of the moose are making use of it. In the long term, it makes moose habitat. There's only two ways that we can make moose habitat, or two main ways. One is by fire, which does perhaps the best and largest job, giving a mosaic of vegetative types rather than just, say, a single spruce forest type look to the landscape.
According to Johnson, depending on the soil and heat of the burn, along with other factors, within as little as 2 weeks, a burned area that appears unattractive to humans becomes quite appetizing for moose. Given the increasing moose population in the burn area, additional habitat will be a significant benefit of this smoke-producing fire.
The moose population on the Tanana Flats is increasing because we've been controlling wolves there for 4 or 5 years now. And one of the limits to the size the moose population can eventually reach is habitat. They haven't been limited by habitat to now. Wolf predation had been the limiting factor. And now, without fires, the next limitation would be habitat. And I think fires like this may add to the habitat available to moose and may actually allow more moose in that area than we would have had without large fires like this.
Johnson requested that it be noted that Fish and Game isn't trying to tell firefighters what to do, just that letting a fire go can be beneficial to game when human life or commerce isn't endangered. And conveniently, in this case, the fire ties in nicely with the department's successful wolf control program, so successful that there were almost too many moose to go around. The Togatelli Corporation of Nenana has a dual interest in the Blair Lakes fire. More moose to hunt would be nice, but the corporation has also selected a good chunk of land, timberland, that is in danger of becoming additional moose browse. Ori Williams, president of Togatelli, has flown over the fire and maintains close contact with the firefighters. The 69,000 acres are deficiency selections that have not yet been conveyed to the corporation. Said Williams, quote, I guess Fish and Game likes the range being cleared off for their moose, but everything has to be weighed, unquote, either in board feet or in freezer space. Karen McPherson in Fairfax. There's a state land disposal going on, and some Fairbanks residents wish the land near them wasn't included in the 56,000 acres being offered. They live in a sort of rural suburbia on Chena Hot Springs Road, a mixture of small farms, cabins, and modified trailers northeast of town. The area in question is called Potlatch Ponds. It's being offered for agricultural rights. The question is whether it's suitable for agriculture at all. So says the Chena Hot Springs Road Association, who has sent a petition with 300 signatures to Governor Jay Hammond, requesting that the 20,000 acres known as Potlatch Ponds be removed from this summer's land disposal offering. Sue Rinkard is the association's secretary.
We have a petition and a classification request addressed to Governor Hammond to stop the disposal and to classify this land as a combination zoning of wildlife habitat and public recreation. We want it left just the way it is, where there's unrestricted access for recreation and where the wildlife habitat is protected, and that's why the dual classification.
The land, located between 3 Mile and 17 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road, has numerous cross-country ski and dog mushing trails, and it's a game habitat. The area is one of the few places in Fairbanks where it's still possible to see moose. The borough has also received a petition requesting that the borough assembly classify Potlatch Ponds a Q zone, a zoning designation that would prevent development.
Our second petition was a petition to the borough to put it into the Q zone, or the holding zone, which is specifically for the purpose of holding something up until a proper development plan can be presented, and we don't feel that the state's disposal plan is in any way suitable. We do not want to Q-zone somebody's property after they have already bought it from the state. That's not the case at all. We want to try to stop the sale, and we felt that maybe the borough could hold it up long enough for the governor to take action.
Not that everyone agrees that action should be taken. Jim Widener is the president of the Chena Hot Springs Road Association.
There seems to be two groups. One group of residents are very strongly oriented to agriculture, and they wish to expand the agricultural area available out there. Another group that lives in a different part of the community wishes to see the trails and various forest areas kept pretty much the way they are. I'm sure everyone realizes that there may be a need for some disposals, but they're concerned that the disposals do not jeopardize, alter, or damage the current quality of life that they now enjoy.
According to Widener, the water table is inadequate to support extensive development, and the state basically has not selected land with agricultural potential.
The state is proposing to subdivide the permafrost.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Last night, the Fairbanks Borough Planning and Zoning Commission declined to approve an easement plant submitted by the state for the Potlatch Pond area along Chena Hot Springs Road, now up for disposal as agricultural lands, land that over 300 area residents contend is unsuitable for that purpose. The commission contended that the plat was inadequate to show sufficient access and was technically deficient. Phil Berrien is the borough's planning director.
There were a number of omissions in terms of showing existing public rights of way and access points and so forth. There were easements to be reserved that were in themselves isolated from other public ways so that it was an easement to nowhere.
I understand that some of the access that was shown had roads running through lakes. Is this correct?
The easements did go through bodies of water. That is correct.
How could this be?
I don't know.
The State Division of Lands may now resubmit a revised easement plat to the Borough Planning Commission, who still must approve those easements.
It is the borough's contention that House Bill 66 required the state of Alaska to satisfy all the requirements of the borough's subdivision regulations, with the exception of construction of capital improvements. So the borough is of the opinion and is taking the position that the state should be obliged to at least properly plat and design the subdivision so that the access points and easements shown are feasible and can be constructed at minimum expense, and certainly at a feasible expense on the part by those people who obtain the land from the state. We feel that designing easements that are not feasible to construct is tantamount to selling land without access.
All told, there were 8 areas deemed deficient by the Planning and Zoning Commission, including utility lines. The plat submitted by the state showed that section lines would be used to provide utility access as well.
The state attorney general has held that utility easements are not necessarily appropriate uses of section line easements. In other words, that section line easements do not necessarily or even actually include utility easements. That was one problem. The second problem was that the utility easements shown had not been submitted to the local utility for review as our platting procedures normally do. And as a result, it would appear that the utility easements shown were inadequate in terms in the judgment of the local utility. So that many of the coordinative kinds of things that the borough planning process normally takes care of had not been addressed nor even attempted in the plats furnished the commission.
I asked Planning Director Berrien what would happen if the land were disposed of in the current land offering without the state resubmitting a plat and receiving approval from the North Star Borough's Planning and Zoning Commission.
It seems to me that they'd be in violation of their own regulations and be in violation of existing state statute.
Karen McPherson, in fact, picking out clothes or groceries can be hard enough, but selecting a group of artworks for an exhibit requires a special skill. Peter Corey, curator of the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka, recently selected work by 16 artists submitted for the first statewide Native Arts Woodworking Competition, sponsored by the Alaska State Council for the Arts. Those 16 pieces, together with an additional 7 from a woodworking workshop taught by Sam Maloof of California, combined to form Alaska Mute, an exhibit of Alaska Native artwork currently on display in Fairbanks.
When you judge an exhibit, pieces that are brought to you for a show, what kinds of criteria do you use?
I think that you should know something about what you're looking at. And if you are talking about traditional pieces, I think that you should have some familiarity with the traditions and with the with other pieces. So you should have seen some of the things and looked at them. And then when you're judging that sort of thing, you try and think, well, does this fit into the tradition as you know it? And where does it fit in a ranking of things? Is it is the craftsmanship good? Is the selection of the raw materials good? Is the execution good? And does it have inspiration? Because like anybody else, traditional craftsmen can be inspired or uninspired. And so those are the things that I would look for in traditional things.
Work was entered in 2 categories, traditional and contemporary woodworking.
In contemporary, I again look at the materials and the way the craftsperson has handled those materials and combined them. And again, I think you should look for inspiration, the thing that sets one piece apart from the other. At some point in time, I think you basically come down to how does it appeal to me as an individual? And there are certainly pieces that end up being selected that way because it may be tied very closely with another piece that is excellent in craftsmanship and selection of materials and the way the person handled everything and put it together, but one just appeals to you more than another. And I think that's the human part of doing any judging.
Corey's methods are decidedly human. He uses no numerical rating system and makes comments on all submissions, whether accepted or rejected, that are then sent to the artists.
I don't think that there's ever a judge that really likes the idea of going in and having to say, even to himself or even to the artist craftsperson on a piece of paper, your piece didn't make it. Because I think everybody should be given a lot of credit because they have gone to the effort to enter. And I don't care what the person or who they are, it takes a lot to submit your thing to be judged.
Artists whose work was selected represented a geographic and aesthetic diversity. Work was submitted from Metlakatla, Dillingham, Ketchikan, Haines, Bethel, Elam, Shishmaref, Anchorage, Northway, Fairbanks, and Washington State. Jurors' awards of $350 were awarded to Kay Hendrickson of Bethel, Paul Narok of Elam, Nathan Jackson of Ketchikan, and Cliff Thomas and Ed Casco of Haines for traditional woodworking. Contemporary Woodworking Jurors Award recipients were Jim Schopert, now living in Carnation, Washington, Ronald Sanungatuk of Fairbanks, Joe Sanungatuk of Anchorage, Dillingham, Sam Fox, and Kathleen Carlo of Fairbanks.
I really enjoy being able to get to see the beautiful pieces. And for each and every piece, there is something great about every one. And, you know, it's a pleasure to be able to see them and to look at them very closely. Something you, unless you work in a museum, you very seldom get to do.
Peter Corey, curator of the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka and juror for the Alaska Mute exhibit of Native Woodworking, showing at the Bear Gallery in Fairbanks through June. The show may also be traveling to Anchorage, Bethel, and Haines, giving more people the opportunity to savor 23 pieces by 17 artists, ranging from berry buckets and masks to abstract sculptures. Karen McPherson in